Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio. I'm Keith Pannell. I'm here with Russ Chianelli, and I'm also here with a guest today who is Craig Tweedy, Professor Craig Tweedy. He's a professor of biological science and the director of the Environmental Science and Engineering Program at the University of Texas at El Paso. Craig's been on this program before. Last time, I think, we did a telephone conversation with you when you were down in the Antarctic. I remember that.
Yeah, I couldn't go down there,
but we did this long-distance science studio.
Yeah, we did, and we did a previous one on our desert research and I think another one.
He's a popular fellow. So he does a lot of things around the Earth, around the country, around the nation, and around the globe. And right now he's very fascinated by what's happening up in the Arctic. And so, Craig, why don't you just sort of summarize where you've come from? People have heard it before, but they won't remember. Where you've come from, how did you get to be here, and what's your current focus?
Thanks, Keith. It's nice to be back. I started at UTEP in 2005, having finished a postdoctoral training program at the Michigan State University. And I came to the U.S. in 2000, having finished my PhD through the Australian Antarctic Program. So the main reason, I guess I came to the U.S. and have pursued Arctic research is that I'm absolutely fascinated by the impacts of climate change on how ecosystems function. And I clearly believe that the U.S. is probably the best place in the world to do that. And the Arctic appears to be responding to climate change more so than any other region on Earth. And there's a whole lot of reasons sort of behind that. But kind of the concept here is that if we can understand what's going on in the Arctic in this rapidly changing environment that we have up there, and what we learn there can be, I guess, relayed to other parts of the globe, and we can, you know, better understand how humans need to adapt in terms of how we live, how we conduct agriculture, and all sorts of other things that we need to do.
So you make the point that the Arctic is a sort of a good experimental laboratory for looking at climate change. Is that something that we've discovered, or is that something that we sort of could have predicted, that this was a place to look at? That was the canary, if you like, in the mine, or did that come as a surprise to people?
I think certainly among colleagues, I think everyone's sort of continually shocked by how quickly things are changing, and also how many sort of surprise factors appear to be sort of right in front of us, and then all of a sudden
can you describe the difference between the Arctic and the Antarctic?
Well, the Arctic is an ocean surrounded by land.
I think be more simple. One's in the north, Russell. That's the Arctic. And the other's Antarctic. And the Antarctic is land, and the Arctic is mainly ice.
Yeah, and then exactly. And so in the Antarctica, many would argue that a lot of the impacts of climate change in the Antarctic are somehow buffered by the Southern Ocean, because you've got this circumpolar current that kind of zooms around the Antarctic. You've got all sorts of crazy wild weather that is clearly buffeted by very predictable pressure systems. And a lot of that helps to isolate Antarctica from the planetary processes going on elsewhere on the globe. But in the Arctic, because you've got land, you've got the heat energy absorbed from the sun is not being dissipated like it would, say, if it hit the oceans, right? And so you've got far greater seasonality in things like temperature, for example. But you've also got kind of a crazier system of pressure systems and whatnot that revolve around the Arctic. And, you know, over the past sort of decade or so, there's some evidence to suggest some of those pressure systems are starting to break down. And, you know, for example, earlier this year we saw the impacts of, say, in the northeast in the US that were hit quite hard with snowstorms and that sort of thing. Now, those pressure systems originated in the Arctic but kind of escaped out of the Arctic and came down to lower latitudes, you know. And this sort of phenomenon is exactly what we should expect with climate change. Not every area on the globe is necessarily warming.
And by climate change, you're specifically meaning increasing in temperatures.
Climate change includes temperature.
Includes that, but I mean, that's a major driving force first?
Yeah, I mean, looking at energy dissipation on the globe, and how the Earth system is responding to that is clearly important. But that also goes into impacting things like hydrological cycles, you know, the evaporation of water from the ocean, lakes, our crops, etc. What happens to that water vapor once it hits the atmosphere, and how it condenses and then falls again somewhere else, usually as rain or hail or whatever, you know. So let's
jump then to what you, Craig, and your group, what are you doing up there? What are the sort of experiments that you're doing to try to evaluate this energy mobility, if you
yeah,
like?
Yeah, we've been doing a whole bunch of different things in the last sort of 10 years. Recently, we've wrapped up what I think is an absolutely fascinating project. It's a project that we looked at literally a half century of the coastline position in northern Alaska. And we did this using very, very high resolution aerial satellite imagery and ground surveys. And what we found is that the rates of coastal erosion in northern Alaska, where we typically work, have increased by 25% to 30% over that time frame. And so this is an area on Earth that's already experiencing some of the highest rates of coastal erosion just through natural processes, okay?
Can you describe something disappearing up there that with 25%?
Yeah. I mean, and when I say 25 to 30%, some of the areas, like our hot spots of coastal erosion right now, are losing up to 8 to 10 meters per year, right? Now, that loss is occurring in only 4 months of the year that the ocean is not frozen, okay? And so, you know, literally, when you break that down to how much is being lost per week, for example, that's a lot of wastage, you know.
Is that due to the temperature of the water or the height?
And this is one of the things that we looked at. We took those long-term trends, but then we sort of said, well, what's driving this, you know? Because what we do know is that in the Arctic, the models that we typically would use for, you know, predicting coastal erosion, that sort of thing, at lower latitudes, simply don't work, okay? So we've got to think about these interactions with frozen soils, the types of material being eroded, and also how that material is then being transported once it hits the marine environment. And so what we found is, you know, overall, you know, the amount of storm activity clearly is the biggest driver. But beyond that, it's the type of landscape that's being eroded is probably the next biggest control of that erosion. And so when we look at what governs that landscape, I mean, you're talking about processes that have occurred for thousands of years, you know. So that is currently dictating modern rates of coastal erosion. And so what we did with this is that we not only did the research into coastal erosion, we also came up with all sorts of new base maps of bathymetry, coastal sediment maps, and things like this. And we've developed a web-based mapping application for the local communities to use in their planning activities, okay? And so we now are working with decision makers in the communities who are, you know, basically making decisions on how their communities are going to adapt to climate change into the future.
I mean, I remember there's some Native American groups up there and in Canada also that are having a great debate as to whether they want to leave and go to some bigger cities, which in a sense means a destruction of their civilization in a way, and their culture.
Yeah.
Or stay there and try to do some short-term defense against the change. Do you meet people like that? I mean, presumably you're going up there and interacting strongly.
Yeah. And our job as researchers coming into a community like this is not to come in dictating
what
communities could do. We're here to help understand what's going on, and where possible, we'll provide data or information that allows for informed decision making. But, you know, with, like you said, there's so many interacting factors here with culture, economics, health and social well-being, preservation of historical sites, et cetera, that need to play into those that decision. And it's a very subjective process that you know, that we simply just don't get into.
And it's also affecting the animals that are there, too, the fish and the polar bears and all of that kind of thing, right? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. Well, it's sort of widely regarded that polar bears and particularly walrus will suffer quite dramatically with the changes that we're observing up there. So this year, just I think the last few weeks, the National Snow and Ice Data Center announced that it's the second lowest sea ice extent for any summer over the monitoring period. So what's happened over the past few decades is an area of ice that greater than the size of Texas has completely disappeared. And not only that, is the ice cap is much, much thinner than it used to be. We're now seeing icebreakers go more or less on their own to the North Pole now. Mm-hmm. Open water has been recorded at the North Pole.
And that's sort of spawning also sort of a bit of a race to try to get up there and think about exploitation
yeah,
of what's
yeah.
underneath, you know, mineral deposits.
Mineral, yep. Right. And there's some active mines throughout Canada and Greenland that have literally been mining for years, stockpiling mineral resources, just waiting for the ice to open up for allowing export. This year we saw the Crystal Serenity, a large tourist ship with thousands of people on board, pass through the Northwest Passage for the first time, okay? It's...
And also minerals opening up in Iceland and Greenland and all that kind of stuff.
Absolutely, yeah. And so, and this is, you know, part of the decision-making for local communities is this, you know, juxtaposition of, like, do we sort of try and hold on to the past, but how do we also expand wealth and well-being for the communities by taking advantage of extractive industry?
Let's just interrupt there, Craig, and we'll come back to it, because global warming is one thing, climate change is, and it's here, right? Where nobody disagrees with that point. The question is, what do we do as a society about this obvious information? And what the scientists in particular, what's our responsibility? But we'll discuss that when we come back. We're going to take a short break. We've been talking with Craig Tweedy, Professor of Biological Science and the Director of the Environmental Science and Engineering Program at the University of Texas at El Paso. We'll be back in one moment. Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, Craig Tweedy, Professor of Biological Science and the Director of the Environmental Science and Engineering Program at UT El Paso. And we were talking about the inevitability, or at least we're getting to that point, the inevitability of society to adapt in very strong fashion to what's happening right now. All right? And there doesn't seem to be that energy around most societies to change. We just think, well, we'll put it off a little bit, we'll tickle away at the edges, but there's no great demand from the political class, let me say, to do big changes because they're going to be very difficult to do. Now, you're an expert, so does that worry you? Does it give you a lot of concern for your future, your children's future, and, you know, my future?
Yeah, I think, I guess, yeah, on the science side, there's a lot of frustration that maybe how do we convey the message that or what's in front of us, and we realizing what's I'd say as a scientist that's looking into the impacts of climate change, you know, the changes that we're seeing are really, I mean, they're big, they're dramatic, and if those trends continue, and there's very little evidence to suggest those trends won't continue, then yeah, that society will have to adapt if our expectation is to maintain a quality of life in an environment that is as stable as what we've known it to be over the last 10,000 years. You know, when I deal with my students in classes, you know, one of the things I sort of encourage them to do is to think of, you know, where will they be around the middle of this century? What will they be doing? Because they'll be at the peak of their careers at that point. They're going to be the first generation to see 10 billion people on Earth. They're going to be managing global resources in an environment that is going to be unprecedented for at least the last 10,000 years, the period at which society as we know it today has basically evolved. So the challenges that they're going to see in their working lifetime are going to be huge. It doesn't matter what they do, whether they become an accountant, whether they're a business person, whether they're a politician, whether they're a research scientist. There's going to be something that they're going to have to do in their working careers with their jobs or with their lifestyle to adapt to some of the environmental change that we're talking about. But that said, I mean, it doesn't take much, you know, surfing on the web these days to be absolutely just amazed with some of the new inventions and capabilities that are coming out.
And that can impact the global warming aspect.
Yeah, and not only slow things down potentially with climate change and whatnot, but it's also increasing human adaptation potential, right? I mean, if you look at the alternative energy field, is booming, right? If you look at the way that we're analyzing big data sets to improve our knowledge, improve models, that's going through leaps and bounds, you know.
Just over the last few years in reality.
Oh, it's incredible. I mean, close to impossible to keep up, you know.
In fact, let me go back to your original sets of data. You were looking at satellite photographs over a 50-year period. And so nobody had looked at these before?
No.
Just sitting there dormant, waiting for someone with some creativity to say, hey, wait a minute, what can we learn?
Yeah, in fact, we rescued probably about a ton of aerial photographs that were literally in a dumpster and being tossed out because of lack of storage space.
So yeah.
We had a covert operation in the middle of the evening that went down, and we literally had undergrads jumping into...
Where was all this data being stored?
It was being stored in local governments in northern Alaska, who were having to move buildings because their buildings were, you know, basically caving in as a result of thawing permafrost. So it's kind of an ironic situation all in all. But part of that move required getting rid of some of this old data. But again, it's just people didn't realize what you can do with some of this historic data. So, you know, we played a key role in rescuing that, and now we've turned that back over to the community in the local library
and lovely.
Made that available to everyone to use. So, yeah, so it always amazes me how inventive and creative, you know, humans can be when faced with adversity. And I think...
if I can just interject here, I just came back from a couple of weeks in Britain. I rented a car. Okay, and I don't like automatics. I like stick shifts. And they've got these new stick shifts that when you go to neutral and stop, the engine cuts out. And you've got to push the clutch to start the engine again. Well, if you're not used to that...
it's broken down all the time, yeah.
But it saves an awful lot of energy.
Oh,
and,
tremendous.
You know, that's just one example. Now, it doesn't work with automatics, and so it's not a big deal in North America, but
so did you get stuck in the middle of a big traffic jam?
I didn't get stuck in the middle of it. I almost caused one. You know? But anyway.
So the ice caps up in the Arctic have been gone and come back over centuries. What do we know about that?
It's true. I mean, climate change is as old as the Earth is, right?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, when you talk about climate change, you've got to be very careful that you don't invoke sort of human-caused climate change, okay? There's sort of two interacting but very different things going on. But they're interacting.
Yeah.
And so we've only got one Earth. We have limited experimental power, technology, and ability to do, you know, big scale science in these really remote and very hard to operate regions on Earth. But I mean, all the evidence to date suggests that how quickly things
are speeding up.
Yeah, and it's clearly on a non-linear cycle. There has been evidence in the past, you know, pre-industrial age, of rapid climate change in polar regions, particularly the Arctic as a result of changes in ocean circulation patterns and various changes in sort of the energy balance of the Earth system and whatnot. But, you know, we haven't seen that in the last half century.
I know I can't remember, but I was reading a review of a book that said that the anthropologists were going to change the name of the period of humans to a new period because the population of the Earth is taking control of the whole climate, like in Southeast Asia, where the people are burning so much stuff just for food that it's really changing in the projections of the population. Doubling and tripling in a few years are going to really change the planet.
Yeah, that's right. It's called the Anthropocene. I guess it recognizes, you know, I guess different periods in the Earth's history are called different names.
Right.
When, you know, it's quite clearly that the Earth system has been through some kind of major change, whether that be climate or a response to a volcanic eruption.
So the Anthropocene is the name of it, and that means that now we're changing the planet, whereas before we lived in the conditions that the planet had, something like that.
Yeah, it's recognizing that the impact of humans on the environment has been so dramatic that it's caused like a step change in essentially how the planet is functioning.
So this is all negative talk, right? And so it should be. I mean, I think we're looking at a terrible future for our children. As you say, in the mid-century, where are you going to be? What are you going to eat? What are you going to drink? And where are all the other billions on Earth going to get the same type of material? What should we be doing now, okay? Just ordinary people, ordinary scientists. There was a big petition signed by like 300 famous scientists, Nobel laureates, telling the political class, look, pay attention. This is not trivial. It's not something you can say is a hoax. It's real. But it doesn't seem to make much difference. What's going to make a difference, Greg?
Well, I think increasingly we've seen essentially people taking their own action, right? And a whole variety of political things over time. So, but personally, I think I'm quite optimistic, actually, of the future. And I think there's a lot of clever people out there. They're going to make a lot of money out of
those
helping
people
us
that
adapt to
buy
climate change.
A beachfront, a property that's going to be beachfront.
Yeah, that's right. But I mean, look at the we're sort of through the age where one solution provides an answer to many, many different things. I mean, that's what the fossil fuel industry has taken us down that road, right? Recovering from that is a very, very different business plan. It's a business plan that has to be tailored to what makes sense for different communities, where that community exists on Earth and the kind of changes that they're adapting to, right? And so when we sort of think of that, it really opens the door to a whole lot of cottage industry, quite literally, right? And so look at today's age of connectivity, sharing ideas and information, the way that we can rapidly manufacture and distribute various products. I mean, it's really an age where the opportunities for small business is absolutely tremendous, you know. And so I think if we can sort of structure our education systems in such a way that we sort of promote creative thinking, innovation, entrepreneurialism, that's some of the best things that we can do to help prepare the next generation to
adapt. And the concept there then is that we got a big problem coming. Governments at the top are incapable of dealing with this, and so local communities will deal with it in their own way, and that will spawn the need for clever entrepreneurs, as you put it, in a local environment.
Exactly. I think, okay. I mean, there's certainly a lot of pressure for top-down decision making, and there's evidence that when that happens, I mean, we've seen that with chlorofluorocarbons, where we've seen governments come together at the international level, make decisions, and then we see the impacts of that policy at the global scale. So we know that top-down decision-making can make a big difference.
When it's very specifically focused.
Yeah.
That's the key.
But historically, people have adapted, is what you're saying.
People are – I mean, humans are incredibly adaptive and creative.
You know, what about the world population? You know, I could see, oh, my land is now not frozen, so I can grow crops for the more than 2 billion people that are going to be here.
Yeah, and so, I mean, but the thing is that you have to have a mindset for change. You can't expect to do what you did or what your grandfather would have done, that sort of traditional knowledge that's in all of our societies. We have to be prepared to embrace that and acknowledge that, admire that, but also ask the question, does that make sense moving forward? And a big part of this is not isolating ourselves, you know. It's not about building walls. It's not about putting up barriers. It's about sharing information and knowledge across the globe and in some ways breaking down borders, you know, breaking down these political boundaries that exist.
There are little success stories here in West Texas, the El Paso Electric Company just became completely independent of the use of coal for generation of electricity, and which I think is a wonderful idea.
Very exciting.
And the final piece of good news I got to tell you both, I just, as I say, in England, and Sussex is in the southeast corner of England, and they are warming up a little bit. And the Loire Valley, where they grow the grape for champagne, all right, they're warming up. But so warming up to the point that damn champagne is too sweet. And so they're buying land in Sussex because it's a little cooler but warm enough now to grow champagne in England. And the French companies are coming in. So this is a great positive of global warming. It's the only one I can think of.
French are retaking England, are they?
Yeah, there you go.
I think we've come to the end of the program, Craig. It's been, as usual, a pleasure seeing you here, listening to you. And I hope one day to join you up there in the Arctic.
Oh, welcome anytime.
I just want to witness you going through garbage cans and other sources of information. Anyway, thank you, the audience, for being there. We know you love the program. That's why we do it. And we'll be back next week with another program. Take care and bye-bye.